For NBC's Coast to Coast network of independent affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable. This week is United Nations Week. As part of the celebration of United Nations Week this year around the world, groups of people are meeting to discuss human rights and their statement in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the Draft Covenant of Human Rights, which are soon to be considered by the General Assembly of the United Nations. But what are human rights? What are the different interpretations of human rights held by the world's peoples and governments? How can human rights be enforced throughout the world? The National Broadcasting Company, the American Association for the United Nations, and the University of Chicago are jointly presenting a new radio home study course to help Americans make up their minds on these questions. This course on human rights was prepared by Mr. Richard McKeon, distinguished philosopher, who was American delegate to the UNESCO Committee on the Bases of Human Rights. This authoritative and interesting course is open to all. You may enroll and begin at any time. Many discussion groups are now using the material for debate and discussion. For more information about this new and unusual brief course on human rights, write the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois, for the brochure describing the course. And your local discussion group can play its part in celebrating United Nations Week by beginning an inquiry into human rights. Today, the Roundtable presents the seventh and last in its discussions of problems of Asia. In this series, the Roundtable has presented a report on communist China and discussions of the problems facing Americans in Asia. For this last program, the Roundtable proposes to examine the great cultural tradition of China, to see if there we will find opposing forces and obstacles to the success of the communist program in China. The Christian tradition in the West is a source of opposition to totalitarianism. Is the great tradition of Confucius in China a similar opposing force to communist totalitarianism? Well, since the Confucian tradition is still such a live force in China, it is bound to have some effect upon the course of developments under the communist regime in China. So, let us consider the various elements of the Confucian tradition which will support and others which will oppose the communist regime. Taking part in today's unusual program on Confucius and present-day China are Hurley G. Creel, a noted authority on Confucius and expert on early Chinese literature and institutions, and Earl H. Pritchard, editor of the Far Eastern Quarterly and historian on modern China. Both participants are members of the faculty of the University of Chicago. And to begin the discussion, we present now Mr. Pritchard.
This year, the 2,500th anniversary of Confucius is being celebrated. To many Americans, Confucius is little more than a name. Who was he? And what is the movement called Confucianism that he founded? Is it a religion? Does it have a leader? Who belongs to it? Is it merely a philosophy? And if so, is it liberal or reactionary? Creel? You have lived in China a good deal, and in writing your book, Confucius, The Man and the Myth, you have studied his teachings and their influence as much as any other Westerner. What is Confucianism anyway?
It's very important, Pritchard. I'm convinced that if the American people, and particularly those who have guided our policy, had a better appreciation of Confucius and his influence and the things his name stands for, we would certainly have been able to deal with the Chinese with far more understanding and much greater success. Now, as for your question about what Confucianism is, that's a lot easier to ask than to answer. Things in China don't fall into exactly the same classifications that they do with us. I wouldn't say that Confucianism is a religion, though it certainly has religious overtones. Primarily, it's a philosophy of life, which has to do both with the moral character of the individual and with the way the country should be governed. It has never had an official head or an authoritative creed or priests or a list of members. Incidentally, that's been its great strength. It could never be entirely suppressed or controlled because you couldn't get at it.
Well, now that makes it sound rather vague, doesn't
it? Yes, in a sense, I suppose it is. And yet there's something pretty solid about a faith that for 25 consecutive centuries has been able to make men lay down their lives cheerfully for what they believe to be right, serene in the conviction that they have fought the good fight and fulfilled the whole duty of man. Of course, most of the Confucian martyrs were highly educated members of the official class. But Confucian ideas affect, and deeply affect, every one of the 500 million Chinese. I've often been surprised at the way one hears quotations from Confucius on the lips of men like Richard Cooley, and the degree of influence that Confucianism has on their lives.
And that influence is something the Chinese communists have to reckon with, isn't it? Not long ago, one of the more famous of left-wing writers in China wrote a book in which he pictured Confucius as a forerunner of Karl Marx. On the other hand, the New York Times recently carried an article saying that Confucian, that the communists had ordered the writings of Confucius burned.
That book-burning story sounds unlikely to me, Pritchard, because the Chinese communists have usually been more subtle in their methods, however much some of them do dislike the ideas Confucius stands for. It's perfectly certain, though, that some of them have denounced him as a reactionary and that others have tried to make him appear an early communist. They're practical people. They wouldn't have bothered to do either one if Confucius were a dead issue. I think, though, that the books and ideas that are labeled with the name of Confucius are not nearly as important as the Chinese way of life and thought, of which Confucius himself is the most famous example, and which he did a great deal to create.
In looking at modern China, I certainly agree that many of the ideas of Confucius, as embodied in the Chinese way of life, are still very much alive. Now, if his way of life is so important, let's go back to the beginning. Let's find out about this man who has exerted such an influence down through the centuries in China. Who was he anyway?
Confucius was born in 551 B.C. in a small town in northeastern China. He was poor, and as a young man earned his living at clerical work. He was very much disturbed by the conditions of the world he lived in. The common people were oppressed and helpless. The feudal nobles lived in great luxury and taxed the people beyond the limit to support it. The aristocrats considered war a game and thought that no real gentleman could be interested in anything but war. The people were the pawns in this game, and of course they didn't enjoy it. It made their lives literally a hell on earth. Confucius, a man without either wealth or position, had the almost absurd idea that he could change these things. He believed that the government ought to exist for the benefit of the people, and that any government that didn't make the people happy was a bad government. Talking about these things, he attracted around himself a group of men who became his students and his disciples. He trained them to carry out his principles as officials, but he was never satisfied with being merely a teacher. He tried constantly, but without any success, to get an opportunity to put his ideas into practice. He died at 72, convinced that he had been a failure.
You see Confucius, then, as fundamentally interested in the problems and needs of the common man.
Yes?
Actually, he has often been pictured, particularly by modern Chinese who want to break down the Confucian tradition, as a rather stern old aristocrat who, although he preached the ideas of righteousness, virtue, and benevolence, thought of these things as governing the relations between members of the upper elite class. But actually, what evidence do we have to settle this controversy one way or the other?
We have a good many of Confucius' sayings preserved in the Analects, though not even all of that material is genuine. We also have a great many accounts concerning the life of Confucius preserved in a number of ancient books. All of these things require a great deal of sifting because there is more that's false than is true. Most accounts do describe him, it's quite true, as a born aristocrat. But the interesting thing is that his ancestry is never mentioned in the early records. And so far as our evidence goes, it was only long after his death, after he'd become famous, that they discovered this ancestry. Confucius himself said, "When I was young, I was a common man, without rank."
But Creel, isn't it a fact that his idea of the way, incidentally in Chinese, the way is called Dao and spelled T-A-O. Now, isn't it a fact that Confucius' idea of the Dao, the way to solve the civil strife and disorder of his time, was to return to an earlier feudal system with an aristocratic class structure?
That's commonly said, but I don't believe it. I can't find any genuine statement by Confucius advocating feudalism. On the contrary, he constantly says that men should be given positions of authority in the government purely on the basis of their abilities, and have a proven intention to govern so as to bring about the welfare of the people. As for an aristocratic class structure, he did more than any other Chinese to break it down. He trained his students for posts in the government, and undertook to make them into, as he expressed it, gentlemen. As students, he took young men of all sorts, and some of his favorite students were conspicuously poor and humble. Incidentally, he succeeded in putting some of them into rather powerful posts in the government.
Creel, one of the things about Confucius which has attracted the interest of Westerners for a long time is the notion that he propounded a sort of golden rule. How about this?
You mean, of course, his statement, "Do not do to others what you would not want them to do to you." Some Christian missionaries have called this the silver rule, to indicate that it's inferior to the golden rule. That can be argued about, but I'd like to point out that Confucius' attitude is by no means merely negative. For instance, he also said, "The truly virtuous man, desiring to be established himself, seeks to establish others. Desiring success for himself, he strives to help others succeed." To find in the wishes of one's own heart the principle for his conduct toward others is the method of true virtue.
I'm certainly glad to hear you bring out that point, Creel. I think that it's very important that we keep in mind this positive side of his teachings. Confucius also taught the importance of the family system. That is, he taught the idea of the solidarity of the patriarchal family, filial piety, and strict obedience to elders.
Yes, Richard, that's certainly true with certain limitations. Confucius says specifically that if your father is wrong, you should remonstrate with him, but tactfully. I don't think he believed that one should do something wrong merely because his father ordered him to. But he never does tell exactly how to resolve this embarrassing situation. There is no doubt, however, that he did lay great emphasis on family solidarity.
Well, what sort of an effect do you think this stress on the family has had on the development of China?
It's had obvious bad effects, and good effects that are very often overlooked. Even in periods of serious civil war, a time when the country was conquered by alien peoples, learning, culture, and civilization in China have not suffered the same setbacks that sometimes occurred in Europe, because these things have been carried on to the family, which has continued to exist even if the state as such was destroyed. Furthermore, the Chinese have not had the same need that we've had to set up such public institutions as old people's homes, insane asylums, and hospitals, because many, not all, but many, of their functions were carried on to the family, which took care of its own. The family has also disciplined its own members, performing many of the functions which we leave to the police and the court. And the family has been a great moral force. The fear of disgracing one's family has very often been a much greater deterrent to crime than the fear of breaking the law.
I'm willing enough to agree with what you have just said, Creel, with perhaps some minor reservations about the need for old people's homes, hospitals, and things of that sort. But it does seem to me that some of the adverse effects have been pretty serious. For example, it has contributed considerably to the high birth rate and overpopulation in China. Probably it has also stifled individual initiative and encouraged nepotism. Perhaps this extreme emphasis on the family has discouraged the development of national solidarity and the capacity of the Chinese to operate effectively as a united nation in times of real crisis.
All these points against the Chinese family system are true, but I think in fairness we have to look at both sides of the ledger. And I'm not clear in my own mind just how much of this can be blamed on Confucius.
Well, Creel, Confucius believed that good government should promote the well-being of the people, and that it should be in the hands of able, well-trained, and honest men. He also taught that people should help one another, and he emphasized the basic importance of the family. Now, what would you consider the most fundamental teaching of Confucius?
Confucius once said, "If a man does not constantly ask himself, what is the right thing to do? I really don't know what is to be done about it." It seems to me that the most fundamental, at the same time the most important thing, is his emphasis on the value of the human individual as such, and his willingness to let all men think for themselves. He believed that education should teach men how to think, but he didn't tell them what to think. He never said that anybody should believe without question what some book said, or what some ancient sages said, or even what he himself said. He only asked that they think earnestly and believe what appealed to their own consciences and reason.
Well, Creel, that sounds as if he had something to do with democracy.
It definitely does, Richard. One result of his willingness to let people think for themselves was that he never seems to have laid down a precise scheme for an ideal government. Too many philosophers who very sincerely want to help humanity begin by working out their ideas for a utopia, and then by wanting to compel people to conform to them for their own good. That results, of course, in totalitarian dictatorship.
Obviously, then, Creel, you see Confucius as a humanistic sort of person with something of a democratic tendency. Would you say that what is now known as Confucianism is the same thing as these teachings of Confucius himself that we've been talking about?
No, Earl, it obviously isn't. For one thing, Confucian philosophers from the 10th century or so onward have felt that they had to meet the competition of Buddhism and Taoism. To do this, they've introduced a great deal of complex metaphysical speculation of a kind that Confucius purposely steered clear of. There have been other changes, too. What differences do you see as a student of modern China?
There are a couple which I think of particularly. First, there was a tendency for later orthodox Confucianism to accept and defend a rather authoritarian imperial system.
Anyway.